Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday the 13th, December 13th, 2013. And when it comes to Guantanamo, it's well past time to...
And together we shut it down, down, down. Shut it down, down, down. You be the baddest girl around, around.
That's the hip-hop crooner Drake. And the song is about a hot chick. But I hear Guantanamo when he sings, "Shut it down, down, down." Yesterday in the Detroit Free Press, the man who was the commander who followed the orders to open the prison camp at Guantanamo in 2002 called for shutting it down. In fact, he regrets that it was ever opened in the first place. He is Michael Lenhart, and his piece is extremely powerful. I will link to it in the show file for this podcast. And we discussed the comments of Commander Lenhart with Michael Ratner, the President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of the agencies that has led the defense of those held at Guantanamo. And he had very sharp comments and endorsed the recommendations of the former commander.
It's an extremely powerful op-ed. I mean, extremely. I mean, even people who say it should be closed don't say what he said. I mean, there were two things that I think stood out for me especially. One was he essentially said this was set up as an interrogation camp and we didn't get very good information from interrogating people. That struck me because when the Center for Constitutional Rights, where I work, litigated this issue, it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, yes, government, you have a right to pick people up in the so-called war on terror, but you can't run an indefinite detention interrogation camp. You can't do that. And yet that is clearly, from what General Lenhart is saying, that's what the United States was running. So it was illegal in a number of ways, you know, the torture and everything, but it was also illegal because it was an interrogation camp. And the second thing I think that's crucial about what he said was how it should be closed. You know, as I'm sure most of your listeners are aware, Obama promised to close it within a year of taking office. That would have meant closed by 2010, 3 years ago. 4 years ago, perhaps, by the time in the next while. And that didn't happen. And there's still 162 people there. And it hasn't happened really in part because of Obama being weak-kneed, because of congressional restrictions, weak Democrats in Congress, Republicans, military running places. But in fact, what General Lenhart said, who was the general who opened the camp, let's remember, said, that look, we now have 82 cleared people who should have, who should be out already. They're not accused of anything. They're innocent basically. They should be out. 82 of them, and we have another majority of what's left, another 80 or so. The majority of those have never been charged or tried.
Right.
And what he says in that article is the Constitution says you can't do that. It requires you release those people. Either you charge, try them, and convict them, and jail them, or you release them. And no one, really almost no one in Congress, certainly no military, have been willing to come out as strongly as that. That's a remarkable statement. It's the correct statement of the law. It just shows how far away from the law we've come.
That's Michael Ratner talking about the op-ed written by Major General Michael Lenhart. And the full interview with Michael Ratner is available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. In addition to the situation at Guantanamo, the untenable and unconscionable way that we're told that somewhere around 80 of those prisoners can expect to be there indefinitely, and they will never be charged. And this is such a violation of fundamental human rights, the rule of law, the treaties that the United States is a party to, that it's got to be dealt with. And Ratner also talks about a few other issues, the NSA, and compares the way the lies about Guantanamo match up with some of the lies we've been told about how spying on Americans keeps us safe. And Michael Ratner also comments on the situation related to Julian Assange, who is his client, and the efforts by Ratner to get the United States government to confirm that it will not pursue charges against Julian Assange if he decides to leave the Embassy of Ecuador in London. Big story broke in the last 24 hours that reveals that Robert Levinson, who is still being held in Iran, was an FBI agent who went on a caper at the suggestion of some CIA analysts and wound up being captured by Iranians, where he has been held since March of 2007. And this story is interesting in a number of ways. First of all, it's an issue that has been held back by the corporate media in this country, and the Associated Press published an article disclosing this situation over the objections of the White House. Then the New York Times chimed in saying, well, if AP is going, then we're going to ignore the White House and report this as well. And there is a legitimate issue here that coverage of the case could jeopardize the safety and, in fact, the life of Robert Levinson. On the other hand, Levinson, his family members, have been struggling to get some attention to his case in order to build pressure for his release. So what we now know is that Levinson traveled to an island off the coast of Iran to meet with an American fugitive that he hoped to turn into an informant. But he disappeared. We don't know exactly what happened there. He's been seen only as a prisoner in a video that emerged about 3 years ago, and in photographs that show him being dressed up like a Guantanamo prisoner in orange garb. I'm sure that's intentional on the part of the Iranians. And since then, U.S. officials have publicly insisted that Levinson went to Iran as a private investigator working on a cigarette smuggling case. But in fact, he was contracted by the Central Intelligence Agency, and that is the other big part of this. It's a huge scandal. Three people were fired at the CIA, in part for the unauthorized spying operation that used Levinson as its front man. The Iranian government has maintained it knows nothing about Levinson. High-ranking American officials have long said privately that they believe the Iranians see him as a spy and that he's being held by a group tied to Iranian religious leaders, possibly the Revolutionary Guard. And so this is a very odd episode, and probably there is more to the story, and it's unclear. With the current negotiations underway with Iran, this tentative agreement that was reached, and it's possible that the U.S. has made overtures to win Levinson's release as part of that process. It's further complicated by the interference of members of both parties in Congress threatening to ratchet up sanctions. And then the White House itself yesterday announced new sanctions against aspects of the government in Iran and companies that have been apparently transferring or laundering money for the Iranian government. And I cannot see, as I mentioned yesterday, how this will help move forward to deal with the Iranian nuclear program without a military assault. And so it's going to be anybody's guess exactly how this plays out. And the revelations about Levinson do add a new layer, a new wrinkle, and perhaps some complications. Well, every time I do a podcast, I like to thank the people who subscribe to the program and help cover my bills and provide the validation that helps me keep this going. And today, I just came back from the post office, and bonus books and the last of the Kona coffee bags went out today to Kaylee Pickenpaw in Richmond, Virginia, to Arlene Boyle in Phoenix, to Dolores in Tucson, and to Matt in Medford, Massachusetts. And another new subscriber who took out an annual subscription declined our bonus gifts because he lives in Ireland. His name is James Quigley, and we traded emails. I'm grateful for his new subscription. And he said, anyway, he doesn't want to give his address because of Big Brother, who I'm sure are monitoring your good self. Sorry, one gets paranoid. Keep up the good work. That's from James Quigley, listening in Ireland. And thank you, James. I do appreciate your comments and your financial support of the program. The other way, whether you subscribe or not, that you can help support us is by taking out a 30-day trial subscription for free from audible.com. And with it, you will get a free audiobook download from their treasure trove of 150,000 audiobook titles that you can download and play on your iPhone, Android, Kindle, MP3 player, whatever gizmo you've got. And audible.com will pay me $15 for each trial membership that comes through the Peter B. Collins web. So follow the link in the show file for this podcast or the banner ad on the left-hand margin of the homepage at peterbcollins.com. That'll take you over to the right page at Audible, where you can sign up for your free trial subscription. And if you cancel within 30 days, it will not cost you a penny. And I thank you for your support. Already, a number of people have taken the Audible trip, and I really do appreciate that. Well, the youthful leader of North Korea appears to be consolidating power. And we learn that Kim Jong-un has ordered his uncle to be executed, and it has happened. The victim's name is Jung Song Thaek, and he was a high-ranking member of the ruling government there in North Korea. And it is fascinating to see this and to see the brutality. Somebody posted online a couple of days ago a picture, and it was an A-B comparison of the very same scene, a picture of Kim Jong-un. And in one of the pictures, Uncle Jang appears in the background. And in the other, which is otherwise identical, he has been photoshopped out. So it's a very authoritarian society there in North Korea. There is no doubt about that. And I want to recommend to you, I mostly read nonfiction as part of my work here. I read 30 or 40 books a year. But the best novel that I've read this year is the Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction called The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson. And it really gives you a very deep depiction of the bleak life in North Korea. And certainly some of it is fictionalized, but the accounts are based on Johnson's very careful research. And if you're at all interested, I highly recommend the book. So Uncle Jang was called a traitor, described as worse than a dog. They say he lost his mind due to his greed for power, that he was plotting to overthrow the leadership and dump Kim Jong-un. Now, that may be completely true, but the way the propaganda machinery works in North Korea, it doesn't matter. The United States has resumed drone strikes over Yemen. On Monday of this week, a strike killed three men in the eastern Yemeni province of Hadramawat. Hope I'm pronouncing that carefully. And then yesterday, a drone strike killed 11 people in what appears to be a convoy of cars returning from a wedding. I thought we only did that in Afghanistan. And this points up so many things. The whole drone program is based on the idea that the lives of American pilots are worth more than the people they bomb on the ground, and that these drones allow us to kill people almost anywhere on the planet at will. And of course, we don't have great on-the-ground intelligence in Yemen. So the remote control toggle jockeys, the joystick operators, don't have the information they need to separate militants from regular people. And the embarrassment that we have hit a wedding party once again just underscores that. Now, these two drone strikes followed a deadly multi-stage assault last week on Yemen's defense ministry that left 52 people dead and for which the Al-Qaeda Yemen affiliate claimed responsibility. And even the New York Times, in its coverage, says, well, there are concerns that the drone strikes themselves may aggravate the problem. Do you think so? Do you? There's a guy named Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-E-N, who is a scholar at Princeton. He's been on our program before. And he's done careful studies. He has visited Yemen more than once, knows the territory. And he said that before we started drone strikes about 3 years ago, there were a couple of hundred people who called themselves members of Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. And since we started killing them, there are now over 1,000. Yeah, that's the simple math as to why drone strikes, well, they create more problems than they deal with. Over the past weekend, Seymour Hersh published a very important analysis of the chemical weapons attack near Damascus that occurred on August 21st. And now UN chemical weapons inspectors have completed a study and issued a report. And it says that chemical weapons have been used on multiple occasions in the fighting between the civil war opponents there of the government of Assad and the array of so-called rebels. And we learn that four other events besides the August 21st attack occurred in the past year. Now, the report, authored by members led by the Swedish scientist Aka Sellström, studiously avoided saying who was responsible for the attacks. And this is the issue that Hersh focused in on, because the Obama administration and Secretary of State Kerry were so definite that they knew, just had it cold, that it was the Syrian government who used these chemical weapons. But Hersh shows that the shell that purportedly delivered the chemical weapons is not the standard used by the Syrian army, and other factors that really give you pause. And so now we have another report about additional uses of chemical weapons without fingering who did it. And with the Assad government voluntarily giving up its chemical weapons, it does lead you to believe that it is the al-Nusra Front, perhaps with help from Prince Bandar in Saudi Arabia, who actually introduced chemical weapons into Syria. Again, we don't really know. But there is significant evidence that causes us to doubt the assertions of the United States, particularly about the Ghouta incident on August 21st. Next week, we will bring you a powerful interview with Max Blumenthal, the young journalist who has just published a book called Goliath about Israel and the Palestinians. And I'm really excited about this. It is a great book. I've got some copies that we'll be giving away as bonus books to new subscribers, so stay tuned for that. One of the issues we talk with Max Blumenthal about is the effort that is underway to force thousands of citizens of Israel who are Bedouins. They're not Jewish. They live in the Negev Desert. And there is a $2 billion plan that is euphemized by the New York Times, described as resettlement, as relocation. But in fact, Israel is bulldozing the homes of these people, pushing them off the land that they have lived on for centuries. They've destroyed this one town 51 times. And it's not a relocation or a resettlement process. They're pushing these people out to make room for Jewish settlements. It is ethnic cleansing. It's part of the apartheid scheme that is, sadly, the obvious feature of the State of Israel. And that's what Blumenthal really focuses on in his book. And since I interviewed Blumenthal, the Israeli government has put a hold on the purge of these Bedouins from this particular area. It's a $2 billion plan that's been in the works for 7 years. And because the critics, like me, who called it ethnic cleansing, spoke up, at least for now, the Israeli government is not proceeding with those home demolitions and the expulsion of the non-Jewish citizens there. Well, as expected, the presidential committee charged with examining the operations of the National Security Agency is back with minor cosmetic changes that they hope will lull the American people into some sort of passive acceptance. The committee's report says that we should continue to collect the phone call records of every American. Oh, they want to put some safeguards on it, some new restraints to increase privacy protections. I don't buy it. The group is also expected to recommend that in the future, when we wiretap foreign leaders, that senior White House officials should directly approve it. And that's another obvious stonewall or whitewash effort. We shouldn't be spying on the private phones of foreign leaders, just in any way, shape, or form, particularly our allies. It really is unproductive, and it just damages trust to a point that makes it really inefficient, ineffective. Of course, Keith Alexander says it would be naive to make major changes to his domestic spying programs. And one of the other recommendations will be that there's some sort of an advocate in the FISA court for the subjects of wiretap orders. I'll briefly recap for you. I believe that General Alexander should be fired, and Clapper should be fired for lying to Congress and for mismanaging their duties and violating the Constitution. I think the FISA court can't be fixed. It should be shut down. And we should return the NSA to its original mission, that it doesn't spy on Americans or so-called U.S. persons. Those are the very simple fundamentals. And, of course, they're not included in any of the proposals in Congress or in this hand-picked committee. And we have to continue the fight. Are you ready for Hillary? Nah, me either. Well, Hillary Clinton gave a speech on Wall Street this week that earned her $400,000. Paid by Goldman Sachs and friends. And over at Fire Dog Lake, they had a mole in the meeting because, you know, as Hillary gives these paid speeches, she's not permitting the press to cover them. Says Clinton offered a message that the collected plutocrats found reassuring, according to accounts offered by several attendees. Saying that it is unproductive and foolish to criticize bankers. The blog post reads, striking a soothing note on the global financial crisis, she told the audience, in effect, "We all got into this mess together, and we're all going to have to work together to get out of it." What the bankers heard her to say was just what they would hope from a prospective presidential candidate. Beating up the finance industry isn't going to improve the economy. It needs to stop. Well, I think that speaks volumes about the intentions of Hillary Rodham Clinton and what kind of a president she would make. And I know a lot of people who are on board with Hillary because she'd be the first female president. Let's get over identity politics and look at what she would be like as president and whose interests she would serve and protect. I think that's the way a decision like that should be made. A year ago, the Senate Intelligence Committee completed work on a 6,000-page report about torture, rendition, and detention that started after 9/11 under the Bush administration. And as I discussed with Michael Ratner in our in-depth interview today, we still haven't seen that report, and it forms the basis of obstruction of justice on the part of Barack Obama in protecting his predecessors. Steve Horn, the prolific and relentless reporter over at DSmog blog, is at it again. Today's report is about Aubrey McClendon, the former CEO of Chesapeake Energy, who is now back in the fracking business and has received a permit to frack 5 wells in the state of Ohio to dip into its Utica shale. McClendon is the former CEO of Chesapeake Energy and now the owner of American Energy Partners. And his group has received $1.7 billion in capital investments to tap into the Utica Shale. The investors include BlackRock, Inc., Magnetar Capital, First Reserve Corporation, and Energy and Minerals Group. And I'll link to Steve Horn's article because it includes a power map of McClendon and his cronies. And I think you'll find that very interesting. Now, while we're talking about fracking, the New York Times reports today that Oklahoma City has been the scene of more than 50 tremors in the past 3 years. And most of them have been minor. Wait a minute. A yearly average of 50 tremors, but this year they have had more than 2,600, including 87 tremors last week alone. Now, most of these here in California, we're familiar with the Richter scale. Most of these are minor events in the threes or fours, but in 2011 they had a magnitude 5.6, and last week they had a 4.5 last Saturday that damaged the buildings, caused them to crumble at St. Gregory's University in Shawnee, Oklahoma. And scientists suspect that it is the wastewater disposal that could be causing the ground to crumble underneath the fracking sites. In any event, I don't consider fracking to be safe. I think it's a waste of water, and it's being used to dredge up the most carbon-intensive muck that we could possibly convert to energy. But we're still doing it. That's America, isn't it? Across the border in Mexico, the new government of Peña Nieto is his name, has announced that they're going to try to open up the oil market in Mexico to foreign companies. They've had a state-sponsored monopoly called Pemex for more than 50 years now. It is, in fact, a source of pride to many Mexicans. And this new pro-corporate government wants to change that and bring in the multinational oil companies, and I'll bet a whole lot of frackers along with them. And finally today, we have learned that 20 villagers in Madagascar have died from bubonic plague. Yes, the Black Death, which we thought was banished during the Middle Ages, has resurfaced and is alleged responsible for the deaths last week near the northwestern town of Mandritsara. And it follows a warning from October by the International Committee of the Red Cross that the island nation is at risk of a plague epidemic. That's a little scary. I hope it's not rats that are transferring it. That's a very, very ugly image, isn't it? Hey, thanks for downloading and listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You are fully authorized to share this podcast far and wide. You can put it up on Facebook. I would appreciate it if you go to my Facebook page, Peter B. Collins Show, and click on the like button there. We've been building slowly with the likes there. But I appreciate your support in every way, and I'm glad you've listened today. And your comments are always welcome. My email is peter@peterbcollins.com or fullofit@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.